Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Bishops in a Bottle on OWU Radio. I'm Shumaita Rahman, and on our panel tonight, myself, Scott Payne, Urvija Rishi, and Kyrie Burton will be discussing the week in news. Today on the program, we have the refugee crisis and how Syria's main opposition group is to go to Geneva as the peace talks open. We're also going to talk about Zika virus and how it's making its way upwards what are the measures being used to tackle this, and we'll be going on to talk about Joe Biden and his talks with the Cypriot president and his talks with Turkey and Israel. And to end things off, we'll be talking about U.S. politics, Trump, Hillary, Bernie, and more. Stay with us as we discuss the top politics on campaign 2016, national and global politics, and foreign affairs on this, the 29th January 2016. It is 6:11, and we are Bishops in a Bottle on OWU Radio. So starting off with the refugee crisis, Urvija, do you want to start us off on it?
Well, I think we've seen that the refugee crisis is not just something that's tearing Europe apart right now, but it's also like a multifaceted social, economic, and political issue. The latest development is that Sweden, and this is the overly politicized news headline, that Sweden is planning to throw out 80,000 refugees, which is not exactly true. Sweden isn't closing its doors to people who are escaping from Syria. Rather, they're trying to limit the entry of economic refugees coming in from Northern Africa and other parts of West Asia right now. Because what happens when a wave of immigration opens is that other people see opportunities, and their lives may not be in direct peril right now. They may just be looking for better opportunities. So,
I mean, we've seen from time and time on, like since 2014, that Sweden has been taking on the most refugees in relation to their population. But, and they've taken on about 55% of most of their applications. In 2014, they took in 30,000 people from 60,000. And in 2015, they took on 81,000 people out of 165,000 applications. Do you think that Sweden should be doing more, considering it's already doing
A lot.
I don't think it should be doing more. I think it's filled to the brim with, you know, what they have been able to do. For instance, in Malmo, where most of these refugees are in the south of Sweden, I was there this summer, and it was a dreadful place. There was clearly a tension between people. And there was clearly hatred and xenophobia brewing in every corner of that city, to the point where even, you know, people that appeared to be American expatriates were being aggressive and violent with anyone who seemed like they were tourists, foreigners, or refugees.
Before we get further into discussion, just a disclaimer that any and all of the political views that we express on this are not our own. These are just to encourage debate and discussion, and we don't identify with these views. Well, I think that you can't really blame any of the Europeans for their current like state of right-wing xenophobic nationalism, as some would like to call it. Because Europe has been going through its own set of crises, agreed that they're economic and not so pervasively political, but for them to see foreigners, especially Muslims, who have been sort of demonized in the entire world, and to not want these people in their countries isn't entirely unjustified. However, given the fact that the world is so globalized and so interdependent in so many ways now, one would think that the Europeans wouldn't be as averse to having people. Yeah. What do you think, Kyrie?
Well, yeah, I'd agree that the expecting so many European countries to embrace so many Syrian refugees, for example, would cause a lot of people to kind of want to distance themselves. I mean, to speak for what I'd imagine to be a lot of the opinion of the people there, would these people are going to come in, they're going to alter their way of life, do things differently than what they're used to, which I mean, if you're talking about millions of people, it will definitely have an effect on the economy and social life. But that said, I still think that I don't think Sweden should be expected to do more than what it's done already. I mean, I believe it's over, you guys said over 55% of the available migrants have gone there. I would like to see the rest of the Western world, including the U.S. and other European countries, step in and help out with the workload.
Okay. In addition to that, recently, last week, Denmark approved the seizing of valuables of the refugees to help pay for the resettlement costs. What do you think about this? Like, is this really fair to take in the last, like possessions that these people have that they brought in from their countries? I mean, but then again, there is the cost-benefit issue of it, too. So what do you think?
I think it really depends on what kind of situations these refugees will be placed in Denmark. If the communities are supportive, if they can find jobs and housing easily.
Well, I mean, clearly it's better than, you know, having the U.S. and armed forces bombing their city and then having ISIS attacking them.
But think about the things the Syrians are bringing with them. They must be things that have survived some sort of hellish trip across the Mediterranean.
Oh, and there's probably some, like, great emotional and even, like, you know, like, monetary value towards
exactly.
it. But, I mean, there's also, you know, you're risking your life to get over to these countries. And, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, it's your life that you're holding most dearest.
Yeah. But you're risking your life and these things, like, just...
I mean, they do have value, of course, but there's the thing, when you're asking and coming from help, do you have that much to ask? Like, can you really be negotiating your terms?
I mean, that's true. You're not wrong.
I mean, yeah, and like we can think, oh, yeah, you know, it would be mean if we took away these things from these people, but at the end of the day, who really cares? I mean, these people are...
Well, I mean... That's true, and I get it from an economic standpoint that a lot of people, you know, you're asking a country to take you in. But still, you have to consider that these are most likely the last things they have that they can hold on to from their past lives that were essentially destroyed, which is why they're running away as migrants in the first place. So, I mean, I personally don't think you should take it, but, I mean, I do understand the economic reasons for taking some of their belongings.
But what I'm wondering is that, are the things that these people are bringing really that monetarily valuable? I mean, they can be bringing... Their land has no value, maybe jewelry, but how much, like, economic value do these things have in themselves? And is it really worth it?
I'd be surprised.
On either side. Is it really worth it on either side?
I believe it would be worth more to the migrants themselves.
And exactly.
Chances are they're not going to have anything worth thousands of dollars on them. So.
Yeah, they probably have clothes or, like, I don't know, family heirlooms.
Yeah, something that has been passed down through the generations.
And
but, you know,
that
I mean.
Will have such little economic or sentimental value to the Danish community at large. It seems kind of strange.
Doesn't it just seem a little, like, I don't know,
it just seems,
malicious for, you know, malice's, you know, sake?
Yeah, it just seems slightly malicious.
Moving on from refugees, let's talk about Syria and how the main Syrian opposition group has said that it will be attending talks in Geneva and maybe, like, as they say, that they will not be negotiating but merely talking. And, you know, peace talks are opening up. So what do you think about that?
Is this the Free Syrian Army that we're talking about?
Yeah, the Free Syrian Army.
I mean, the Free Syrian Army is actually going there to get help on humanitarian issues. They actually don't want to negotiate at all.
Yeah.
Which is fair, I guess, given the situation that the more immediate sort of concern is humanitarian supplies and putting an end to, you know, direct conflict and...
It also
war.
Depends on what countries will be there in Geneva with these
I think
Free Syrian
U.S.
Army.
And Russia are definitely going to be there.
Oh, yeah.
So the High Negotiations Committee, the spokesman for the High Negotiations Committee, Manzer Makus, said that they will be issuing a detailed statement where they will announce if they will be, like going to Geneva, but there will be no talks unless certain humanitarian demands are going to be fulfilled. So, like,
I realize that the Free Syrian Army has backing from the United States, which gives them some power to negotiate in Geneva. But given that Bashar al-Assad has been backed up by Putin, Russia, and still has institutional power within Syria in the sense of military control and such, I don't know how well these negotiations will work.
Or if there will be any results at all.
I feel like it'll become a impasse of sorts, because the U.S. will be supporting all of their issues and Russia will be denying all of them. So this is just like a stalemate, and it's very reminiscent of the Cold War if you think about it, because Syria has technically become a divisive issue for U.S. and Russia as well.
Yeah. Scott, do you have anything to say on this?
I mean, I agree with Orvija. You know, it's become another proxy war, and I think, you know, when America and Russia don't want to come to blows with each other, whether it's because of nuclear holocaust or, you know, well, basically that, then, you know, we have to fight amongst each other with other people and cause trouble in their country.
Very.
Well, yeah, I mean, overall, I agree with Scott on this one. Whenever you have two countries such as U.S. and Russia, they're going to want to, whenever they pick an issue to fight over, they're going to do it. However, I would like to see, at least hope that they can get some, at least basic humanitarian aid in this, help the people, because a lot of the people involved obviously have nothing to do with the actual conflict. There are plenty of innocents involved in this, so I want to see if they can at least hash out a program to help them.
I mean, if you think about it, it's really interesting how since like the 1950s when the Cold War began to now, there isn't any major region in the world where U.S. and Russia haven't come to like a proxy war. It's happened in Asia, it's happened in Europe, it's happened now in the Middle East, in Latin America and Africa. I think the only continent it hasn't touched is Australia, and just really makes you wonder if this is how their relations are going to progress. Then are we looking at like potentially more such?
I mean, unless there's another region in the world that's as unstable as the Middle East, which, I mean, there's Africa, of course, but no one's really looking at Africa at this point.
We just need Africa to discover something, like oil, and watch what happens.
Yeah. or maybe Russia will get another warm water port there or something.
Well,
or build a missile base since they're fond of
them. Yeah, whatever.
Well, the meetings were a part of like a outline in the UN resolution last month that envisages an 18-month timetable for a political transition in Syria, including drafting of a new constitution and elections, possibly. Like, how well do you see Bashar al-Assad like cooperating with that whole idea of it? It seems like,
I think with ISIS added into this lovely cocktail, it complicates things for the Free Syrian Army and Bashar al-Assad, because his country is being torn apart, so his institutional power, as it is also lessening as ISIS is gaining control. So there is room for negotiation, because Free Syrian Army and Bashar al-Assad working together to fight off ISIS is perhaps more beneficial to everyone, I'd like to hope, believe.
I mean, no one would allow that if it meant that the opposing party will gain any more power.
I think the elections are supposed to be to give like some form of freedom of choice to the people in terms of who they vote for, and not like direct control of everything. So it's sort of a power sharing mechanism that they want to try out, from what it sounds like, not a direct like change or transition of who's the most powerful.
Well, moving on from Syria, let's talk about a more up-and-coming international emergency, the Zika virus. The World Health Organization said that the mosquito-borne Zika virus may infect up to 4 million people and they convene that if the outbreak, they are still deciding if the outbreak should be declared an international health emergency. Scott, do you want to start us off about this?
Okay, well, the Zika virus is an RNA virus coming from that, is an RNA virus from the genus Flaviviridae. And in Latin, it means yellow fever. It's the virus is in the same genus as dengue fever and West Nile virus. What it essentially does is it hijacks the protein producing part of your cells, which are your ribosomes, by the RNA mimicking your messenger RNA, which is what produces your proteins. What it causes really is a symptom of your head shrinks if your mother has it during pregnancy, and so it can cause several mental disabilities and issues with just growing up and that sort of thing. It's been active in the human population since around 2009. Its vector is a mosquito that I believe is from Egypt. Its name is A. aegypti, which means just from Egypt, the mosquito from Egypt. And the vertebrates that it's found in are in primates, so us and other like just the monkeys.
Doesn't it represent the very issue in world healthcare right now, though?
Yeah, it's been here since 2007 or 2009. Now it starts. It says began in 2007 right here, the pandemic.
But now
it's getting close to America and white countries.
And that's when people need to find
a
cure. That's
the sad truth in the end of the day.
Brazil, I believe, has been hit the hardest with it, with the most number of victims.
Last year, the virus was detected in the Americas, and now it's spreading onwards to Europe and Americas. Yeah. And the cases of the Zika virus have been reported in 23 countries and territories in the region.
Yeah,
and
the scary part is that this vector, Aedes aegypti, the mosquito is now being able to adapt to other regions in the world, regions that they were once unable to live in. For instance, there have been traces of this particular mosquito in the DC area for 2 years now, and they've been able to survive the winters in Washington, D.C.
Oh, wow.
So clearly the pandemic is spreading because this particular species of mosquito is becoming more adaptable to the different climates of the world. And it's not just being sustained in Africa and equatorial countries in South America.
I believe that there is no specific vaccination or treatment available for it right now.
No,
there isn't. They say that it could take months, if not years, to find a vaccination that can be used widespread. That can be publicly used and stuff, but they're hoping to start human testing for possible vaccinations by August of this year. So they're hoping to have emergency cases solved by the end of this year. But
what's scary about this bacteria, or not this bacteria, this virus is it's not like the crisis that we had with Ebola.
Yeah.
Where Ebola's it's hard to catch Ebola. You would have to have, the bodily fluid of someone who has it to contact not just your skin but just the inside of you. And so it's hard to contract Ebola, and it's also hard to it's hard not to notice that you have it, since after 10 days then you're hemorrhaging and bleeding from every pore in your body. But where Zika virus,
you don't know that you have Zika virus until...
Yeah, it shows up as a fever, I believe.
Yeah, yeah, until it might go away until you have like a child. And just recently in the news, El Salvador is now telling its people to stop having children for a whole year just in order to make sure that there aren't any more children that are born with these just very sad deformities due to this virus.
I mean, hopefully, though, they can come up with something soon. But, yeah.
It sounds to me like it sounds to me like this is something that we can overall deal with eventually. It doesn't sound like it's something that's going to hit us out of the blue.
I mean, the WHO, because they were criticized so much during the Ebola breakout in Africa, they're actually having some sort of an emergency meeting to do like a region-wide sort of discussion on how they can deal with it and what are like the key steps that need immediate concern. So hopefully, like, since all of these like organizations and research scientists are coming together and like discussing this.
So moving forward now, and we're going to be talking about Joe Biden and his discussions with the Turkish Prime Minister, President Netanyahu in Israel, and also the Cypriot President, Nikos Anastasiades. Let's start off with Turkey and Israel first. He's been talking about how, like, just the relations between the two countries and like how to improve them, and also about energy cooperation in the Eastern Mediterranean. Like, what do you see in terms of the relations between these two countries?
Orvija, do you want to bring us up to date on the history of the relationship between Turkey and Israel?
Sure. Well, Turkey and Israel, I guess, have a lot of issues. I mean, clearly the main divisive one has always been religion and how pretty much everyone in the Middle East hates Israel and, you know, is very anti-Semitic or anti-Zionist, whatever they might like to believe. And Turkey and Israel specifically also have some territorial issues, like the entire thing with Kurdistan is something that has happened there before as well. So, I mean, Netanyahu doesn't like Erdogan. Erdogan doesn't like Netanyahu. That's also something that becomes very problematic. And Israel usually finds itself without an ally in its vicinity, considering its relations with Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and the rest of the countries. I mean, its main ally through all this time has been the United States, and one wonders how long the U.S. support will sort of sustain Israel in the region, given that Iran's getting more aggressive and so is Saudi Arabia.
But doesn't that make it even more important for the United States to maintain its position in Israel?
It really depends on how the United States does a cost-benefit analysis of its relationship with Israel, because at what point is it worth defending Israel at the cost of losing possible diplomacy and relationships with the entire Middle East.
Mm-hmm. And to further that thought, if the U.S. were to stop supporting Israel as much, it would also make Israel much more willing to come to the table to work out a peace negotiation and working with other countries, including Turkey and its other neighbors, because currently if you have the backing of one of the strongest countries on the planet behind you, you don't exactly have to bargain as much as you would if you were in Turkey's place. Or,
I mean, don't you think that would go either way, though? Israel has also been restrained to some degree by the United States in terms of, like, just military action, because I remember back in the 70s, the Mossad went into Iran, dropped some missiles or something on one of the Iranian cities, and for 24 hours nobody knew that Israel had done this. They actually had to like announce it themselves because it was just such a well-done operation. But that aside, Israel has been restrained to some degree in its like actions in the region because of the United States. So it's a possibility that without U.S. support, Israel would get more aggressive and actually like come to some direct confrontation with any or all of these countries. Which, again, given the situation in the Middle East with ISIS, with Syria, with just generally how unstable the entire region is, wouldn't be the best. Like, it's just also interconnected that it's very hard to, like, you know.
I mean, yeah, there's so much going on in that country, and it's not like, you know, their aggressiveness is restrained because they're not bordering Israel. They have Hezbollah that they support, the terrorist organization in Lebanon, and it's really just Israel against the rest of the Middle East.
And Israel has its own lovely set of like internal problems with Palestine and like the Gaza Strip and PLO and everything. It's just not.
Turkey doesn't seem to be like Israel's first priority. That's just
true, but
wouldn't Israel's first priority always be like reclaiming Palestine?
Probably, but given again, Israel could only benefit from slight cooperation with Turkey. I don't know how much Turkey would benefit from cooperation with Israel.
Plus, it would, again, like, back to what I just said, it would take a lot for Israel to regain Palestine. And Palestine's what? It's now identified as a state? Or
observer state in the UN?
State.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's been given that status. So that entails some sort of, like, semi-autonomy of Palestine, which, of course, Israel can't.
The Vatican even is recognizing Palestine. Like, this is different times from you know, the Crusades.
Well, indeed. Stemming off from Turkey, let's talk about Cyprus and how U.S. Vice President Joe Biden phoned the Cypriot President Nikos Anastasiades, to discuss a settlement deal on the divided Mediterranean island. The thing about Cyprus is, in general, that this dates back to the later part of the 19th century when the Ottomans like took over the island after from the British, and like after that, like that stemmed on for a while. There were like ethnic differences in the island with the Turkish people and the Greek people, and with the help of a Cypriot group in the region, Turkey invaded the northern part of the country, which led to a sort of like de facto administration over there, which isn't recognized anywhere in the world except for
Turkey.
So this meshing of the two like peoples and like considering the historical differences and everything, do you think it's very likely?
I mean, look, if France and Germany can be side by side and not be going to war, I'm pretty sure anyone can do it. But the interesting thing about Cyprus is that the Turkish population is significantly lesser than the Greek population, and the Greek side, so to say, is always is the actual country versus the Turkish side, which is more of a,
It's
like a semi-autonomous, we're kind of a country, but we're kind of with you deal. But they have been talking about, like, unification for a while. And given that these aren't, like, violent differences anymore between the people, more like, so, anymore.
Yeah, I mean, there really isn't any more tension on the island.
Yeah, it's more like social differences, prejudices, and, like, just general, like, cultural differences.
Yeah.
Which can be integrated. So this is an issue of diplomacy.
Yeah. And I mean, like, there's the issue where, like, the Cypriot Turkish people seem to feel exploited by both Turkey and the Greek side, and they're kind of caught in the middle where they have to decide which is lesser of the two evils.
Pretty much.
And at this point, I can see, like, a potential negotiation for unification rather than staying with Turkey, considering how Turkey hasn't exactly been the most helpful in the last 40 years or so of its occupation.
Yeah, their like kinship with Turkey is purely cultural at this point, because they're like that Turkey's little brother that Turkey doesn't care about but occasionally steals toys from. I mean, if they can actually come to some sort of like compromise with the Greek Cypriots, then you could actually see that nation flourishing. Nicosia wouldn't have to be like a divided city anymore. And just, if you think about it, the Turkish Cypriots would benefit more by being with Greece, because the Greek side of Cyprus is part of the European Union. So just general like benefits for a Turkish Cypriots would be more. But
there's also, what's interesting is that there's so much dispute over property ownership, yeah, and mm-hmm. things like that, where when the Turkish people annexed the northern part of the country, they basically took all the land from the Greeks that owned it. And once, if northern Cyprus is ever unified, or if Cyprus is ever unified again, the families of those Greeks are going to want their land back.
And then
there will be a whole...
Wouldn't they already have just settled down?
No, this is something that dates back to, like, this is a prejudice that is the main issue of conflict, that they believe that their land's been stolen, that their properties and their businesses have been stolen by the Turkish Cypriots. And, like, if there were an unification, the government could possibly help them reclaim their land.
Given that the government is Greek.
Given that the government is Greek. And this would put the Turkish Cypriots in a completely...
It would disenfranchise them once again.
Yeah, because given that the Turkish Cypriots who are there now aren't the ones who did the stealing of the land, so to say. Like, the families that are living there now aren't probably the people who came in and, like, stole the land. And to take it away from them is also somewhat unfair, because that's their home.
But how do you explain that to people who feel like their family lands have been stolen?
See, there's really no right or wrong in this. It doesn't, like...
But, I mean, that's one of the issues that they would potentially have to deal with, provided there
was because you can give some people their land back and not give others their land. It really depends on how, like, they want to... I mean, could they give them different land? Cyprus is an island. There's barely any land to give out as such. But honestly, I don't know what's the end to this. I don't.
There'd be enough issues to tackle to get to unification, but what will happen after it is its own...
Yeah, I think social integration will have to take a back seat with the property, but I really don't know. Can't predict.
Do you have anything to say about that?
Well, there's not much for me to add to that, but I do hope, you know, that I can see the argument from both sides, why both sides would feel upset in case of unification if either side were to gain or lose the land. So I'm hoping, you know, fingers crossed, that they can come up to some kind of agreement that benefits both parties. I don't know, maybe sharing the land.
The Pareto efficiency of politics.
If only politicians were economists.
Or economists were politicians. Yeah. Or they talked. I mean, I feel like if they talked, things would be a lot nicer.
Yeah. So, going on to North Korea's missile issue, like, do any of you want to start us off on that?
North Korea with weapons is like the kid who cries wolf, essentially. They keep wanting to build all these weapons and wanting to, like, bomb places and keep giving out threats. At this point, it's really hard to, like, gauge the truth behind this, the intensity and the, you know, actuality of this new threat from them.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, North Korea has been putting out its own propaganda related to what it can or can't do. Earlier in the year, they said they had developed an atomic weapon, but scans in the area and based on seismic activity have dictated that it was more of an H-bomb, which, I mean, is still effective, but it's nowhere
only an
near.
H-bomb.
It's nowhere near the same level as an actual atomic weapon.
Or even a nuclear one. actually, one funny anecdote is that South Korea has been playing K-pop across the border and, like, South Korean news, so that people in North Korea who live near the border can actually, like, hear things that aren't, like, just propaganda from their, like, leader. And it's really funny how there's, like, videos of South Korea just playing K-pop.
Well, we knew it from the start. K-pop, the next weapons of mass destruction.
Clearly.
Yeah.
Definitely. The conflict between North Korea and South Korea will never cease to be interesting.
Well, as long as Lil' Kim's around.
And Lil' Kim. Does he have kids?
No, he does not.
Not yet?
Not yet. Mm.
He's still a young, virile man, I'm sure.
You never know. The South Korea might be auditioning new K-pop stars tomorrow for their next missile defense program.
Mission K-pop.
Yeah. So moving on to a more domestic crisis, we're going to be talking about the water issues in Michigan. Kyrie, will you fill us in on that?
Sure. All right. So for those of you guys who haven't heard, in Detroit, in Michigan, Flint, Michigan, to be exact, the water has been found to have insane amounts of lead in it. I mean, the water there is basically orange. So, and this story goes back to the original root cause of this is that originally the water source that the government was using there for their water, they decided to switch it. Now, reports state that they were switching from one of the Great Lakes to a river there, and that this would save the state about $1.5 billion.
Oh, wow.
$1 million with an M. So, however, once they did this, people started to complain naturally that the water was orange and that it wasn't being treated properly. And the government there was stating over and over again that it was perfectly fine. There were pictures in doctor's offices stating that it was perfectly fine to use this water to clean, to wash up and, you know, wash yourself with, that it wouldn't mess with your skin, wouldn't get in your skin fast enough to mess with it. Fast forward to today, and it's officially been declared a national crisis, and people have been ordered to not use the water. Public schools have been forbidden from having actual running water there. They're all being forced to use bottles. And to add another wrinkle to this story, it turns out that Governor Rick Snyder, I believe is his name, had ordered the people working under him in his offices large cases of bottled water so they wouldn't have to use the tap there. And this was long before the actual story broke, which does show that he might have already known this has happened.
I mean, hasn't their water supply also had like a bunch of lead in it for a while, like at least a year since they discovered that? And yeah, it's the U.S. attorney is supposed to investigate this. I wonder. But what's the alternative here, though, Kyrie? Like, how would they switch back to clean water?
Right now, the governor stated that it would cost $1.5 billion to replace all the pipes. So for them switching, he said that switching back to the original water source and taking out all the pipes, because originally, as you stated, the water was already messed up, but they had to treat it with something. And when they went back to the other pipes, the corrosiveness in the water messed with those pipes, releasing the lead. So right now, the governor doesn't intend to switch over in his short-term plans. He released a statement saying that his short-term plans were just to have everyone keep using water and just applying water, which I don't know if you would know. Using bottled water for day-to-day activities
isn't crazy. It's crazy. No, it's going to get expensive. People won't be able to afford bottled water all the time. And it's just, it's not feasible at all.
And then to further eliminate the economic issue is that although the water is tainted, the water company there is still releasing bills and statements to the people saying that if they don't pay their water bill, they'll turn off the water, which under the law there dictates that if you don't have running water, it's not considered habitable for your children, thus they can take their kids away. So again, it's a mess of issues wrapped up all in one there. So.
Poor Flint residents.
Hopefully an issue that will
get resolved soon. At least to some degree.
Yes. So moving on to the most exciting segment of our program, the presidential campaign the elections in 2016. I would like to start us off all with the current polls. The general polls for the Democratic presidential nominations put Hillary Clinton at 52% and Bernie Sanders at 37.3%. In Iowa, in Iowa, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders are pretty neck to neck, with Hillary Clinton at 46.8% and Bernie Sanders at 44.3%. But in New Hampshire, Bernie Sanders has a big lead with 53.3% and Hillary Clinton dropping to 38.6%.
Go Bernie.
Yeah. And for the Republicans, we have in general we have Trump leading with 35.3%, and up next is Cruz with 19.7% and Rubio with 10.7%. Carson has 8.3%, but I don't think he's relevant anymore at this point.
Nobody cares about Carson anymore.
Poor Carson.
Poor Carson.
Poor Carson.
What's O'Malley at, if anything?
O'Malley is in Iowa. He's 4.3%.
Just stop, O'Malley. Just leave.
Yeah, I mean, in New Hampshire, he's 2.9%.
Just leave, dude.
Yeah. Overall, he's at 2.1%, so that's just kind of sad. For the Republicans in Iowa, we have Trump with 31.4%, with him taking his percentages dropping from 33 to 31 in the last couple of days, as did Cruz's. But Rubio picked up slightly from his 11% to 14%. Which, I mean, I wonder if it's the result of the last debate. And in New Hampshire, Trump is at 31.3% and everyone else is at 12. Oh, wow, Kasich is actually at 12.5. Like, who would have thought?
Go Ohio. Kasich.
Yeah. Ohio represent.
Much represent, indeed.
Yeah. Well, Kasich is at 12.5, Cruz 12.0, Jeb Bush at 10.2, and Rubio at 10. So, Trump seems to be leading everywhere. Bernie seems to be creeping up on Hillary. What do you all have to say about the...
Well, it'll be Bush versus Bernie. Or not Bush versus Bernie. Trump versus Bernie for 2016 probably.
That sounds like madness.
Yeah.
That sounds like mayhem. Political
riots,
mayhem.
Murder.
That's a fight for the country right there.
Yeah.
I mean, they're... supporters are so radical. Yeah. Both of their supporters are complete opposites.
Both of the Democratic and the Republican establishments are, like, you both see them trying to distance themselves from their party members. Nancy Pelosi isn't really supportive of Bernie's new plan for the income tax.
But Obama just did meet Bernie recently.
Obama just
and that's a very Bernie. Subtle... It's not an endorsement. I'm not going to say it's an endorsement, but that's a subtle sign, if you were to perceive it that way.
I mean, you don't know if he's going to meet Hillary Clinton soon, so, like, you know, we can't make it...
I mean, he has to meet... Like, Obama, I feel like he doesn't like Hillary Clinton at all, but he may be pressurized to, like... directly
endorse
her, given how everyone's promised
2008 went down.
Yeah, given how everyone's promised Hillary 2016. So,
that's interesting. I mean, I wouldn't even say that President Obama dislikes Hillary, because it was his earlier interview, I believe it was CNN, where he kind of gives Hillary Clinton the nod, stating that Bernie's the infatuation with Bernie is more of the new thing. That being said, I definitely see parallels from Bernie Sanders and what Barack Obama did, and that was against Hillary, so...
I mean, Obama and Hillary have never agreed on policy. That's been one of their main issues, and you can always tell that there's some friction between the two. But, again, given how 2008 and 2012 happened, Hillary's gonna act like she's entitled to the presidency.
I mean, she's acted like this since the start of, you know, like, any debates for the presidency.
Yeah, I mean, the latest Democratic debate, that was a couple of weeks ago, there were points where it seemed like she just didn't care about what she said because it felt like she would just
she
win.
Yeah,
it's
an open and shut case.
Yeah.
I'm the president.
I'm the freaking president already.
Yeah.
Yeah, but she's definitely starting to feel the burn.
Clearly. What about Trump not showing up to the Republican debate and having his own little event?
I was just going to read out the numbers for that. Trump had his own rally at the same time that Fox News did their broadcast of the debate.
Was it Drake University or something, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Fox's Trump-less debate had 12.5 million viewers, which is the second to last.
Yeah, it's a pretty low number.
It's a pretty low number considering the... like the smallest amount of viewers that they got was 11 million viewers in another Fox News Business Week or some other Fox related channels debate. But this did hit them pretty hard. In comparison, Trump's fundraising event on CNN and MSNBC had about 2.7 million viewers combined. But considering how quickly he put that
and 700 people present at the rally as well.
Yeah, 700 people present there too.
I mean, he organized it pretty quick and not badly.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty commendable considering the scale of a GOP debate versus like
just him.
Just a fundraiser rally.
Yeah. So, Trump does pull people towards him, maybe not the right kind of people, maybe he's not the right kind of person. I won't comment, but he's got some support.
Yeah, he has that sort of charisma to him. Where, you know.
I gotta admit, him avoiding the GOP debate, I think that was a pretty smart move on his part. Because, I mean, I don't know if you guys watched it, but seeing how Megyn Kelly became prepared to take out Rubio and challenge Cruz on that makes you wonder if she had been prepared to take on Trump like that, what did he... Did he avoid the harsh questioning that he was really afraid of? Because, I mean, I'm going to call it. I think him avoiding the debate is going to end up helping him in Iowa.
I mean, Trump isn't exactly known for answering questions or being particularly knowledgeable about public policy in general. He seems to just make things up as he goes along.
I think that, you know, like, it was a pretty, I don't know, it was pretty, ballsy move for him to. For him to do that.
I think he's anything but.
I mean that's classic Trump.
Yeah.
I mean,
so
in the end of
all
the day,
balls, no substance.
In the end of the day, Trump is an entertainer, and this is a publicity stunt. Like.
I mean, yeah, you know, it's.
I really do wonder if it's a conspiracy, though. I mean.
Would you like to tell us more about this conspiracy of yours?
Well, okay. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are very good friends. Trump gave Hillary lots of money. Trump owns part of the company that gives Hillary a lot of money. Trump has been running for elections, taking all the attention away from the Republicans, giving Hillary a lot of space to garner support from Republican supporters who are more like more centrist Republicans. And Trump didn't show up to the debate. Trump could drop out of the...
I feel like he would get lynched, though, if that were to happen. His supporters
okay,
seem
Trump's
manic at some
gotten
point.
Gotten away with a lot worse than...
Well, yes, but this is a whole different...
Level
of things, because these are people who are counting on Trump to save them from whatever stranded state that they believe Obama's put them in.
Clearly.
They think Trump is going to be the answer to all their problems, all the, like, to have guns and to have whatnot. And, like, you know, these people want Trump for the very reasons that we don't like him.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, if he...
But imagine if Trump actually... Do you think that any of his policies, building walls in front of Mexico, are things that could potentially ever get passed by Congress?
I mean, did you think that he'd still be leading when Iowa comes around? I'm not surprised, though. That's the thing. I think that what we can take from this is to, like, you know, expect the unexpected from someone like Trump. See how, you know, I mean...
whether his policies are good or bad, he's charismatic enough to get them passed.
Are they implementable, though?
I think that question is irrelevant when it comes to his policies. If they're implementable, like, but what you're saying is, if you put them in, will they last and will they do something good?
Will they even get passed? I'm not talking about their benefit right now. I'm talking about their like ability to make it pass. Congress.
I think that Trump would either be a stagnant capital where nothing is happening, or it would be a circus.
Yeah, I feel like Trump seems like someone who would be pushing executive order after executive order to have
absolutely.
Things his way. Because I don't see Trump letting the Congress push him around.
But I don't see Congress letting Trump push them around either, is the thing.
Yeah.
Given that the Republicans hate him in general, the Democrats hate him, he will have very little support from his legislators. That's the thing.
He will, but the Republicans still owe a certain level of loyalty to him if he is going to be
their candidate.
Going against Trump now for the Republicans could amount to ripping the party in two.
But imagine, there's already Republicans who are leaving. That's the thing.
That's what the Republican elites are really worried about right now, because, I mean,
the establishment is crumbling. Mm-hmm. And now there's this, like, quote-unquote grassroots stuff that's building up with the Tea Party, and the Tea Party's feeding into, you know,
Trump's thing.
I mean, it's not just the Tea Party that's feeding into what Trump has to say. It's everyday Americans. It's staunch conservatives. It's moderates. It's anyone who feels like more or less like, you know, disenfranchised, cheated, or whatever it may be by the government. I don't think that this is an issue that the establishment could easily fix, since the people are very upset at this point in America's history.
Do we want to do like 15-second wrap-ups of what we think, who's going to be our candidate on either side for the primaries?
Sure.
Kari, would you like to?
All right. For the Republicans, I'm calling it, I think Trump's won already. Based off his last performances in Iowa, he's utterly crushing Ted Cruz in New Hampshire. I'm calling Republicans, Donald Trump's going to win. For the left, for Democrats, I'm hoping Bernie Sanders comes out. I think he can do it. If he gets through that, I think he'll have a much easier time than general.
But I think the consequences of a Trump-Bernie showdown may actually be a lot worse than a Trump-Hillary showdown.
Yeah, but I agree with Kyrie. I think it would be Trump and Bernie, and
I think it's going to come down to them.
I think it will be that, and I think that there will be
madness
in America.
Let's get ready for the show.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think it's going to come down to Trump and Bernie, but I am genuinely afraid of what will happen if comes down to Trump and Bernie.
Well, for me, I mean, I would hope for the Democrats it's Bernie Sanders, but, I mean, Hillary Clinton has been promised this position, and I mean, like, if
I would love, though, if Hillary didn't get the presidency. I would just adore
here.
It. It would give me such a deep sense.
She happens to be the most pandering politician that I've ever seen.
I don't know if she has any opinion at all. I can't support her because I literally do not know where she stands on anything.
Anything at all. And, like, that's the thing. Like, for Republicans, Trump is a shoe in, obviously, and for
it seems like it.
Yeah, and like for hopefully, if New Hampshire and Iowa goes right, then we'll have Bernie Sanders.
Quick question, Scott: if Trump does get elected in the horrible circumstance that he does get elected, do you think the Electoral College could stop that? Could they?
I mean, I think the issue with an Electoral College accepting people is that the election in the year 2000 with Gore and Bush, it was so close, and then Gore did have a higher vote, but I don't think the Electoral College can just say, oh, we don't want this person, and so we're going to
do that.
So
do you know of the sort of Like,
I don't know the exact inner workings of that sort of thing. Kyrie, do you know?
I know very little, to be honest. Yeah. But even if they had, I don't think they'd risk doing that. I mean, if based on Trump supporters, if he wins and they take it away, riots and streets.
Oh God! Yeah, shootings a mass.
That would tear the country apart on that one.
I mean, I think Bernie and Trump just being in the, if they are in the elections together, would tear the country apart because all of these left-wing socialists who have this whatever idea of, you know, utopian communism, social democracy and such, and all of these right-wing gunslinging nationalist
fascists.
Well, you said it. Yeah, I didn't. It's just, I see no compromise there. Absolutely not.
It's communism against fascism. That's
the age-old war.
The age-old war, yeah.
Well, hopefully we'll find out on February 1st when the Iowa caucus takes place, so that'll be a good indicator for what's happening. Even though the Wisconsin University polls, which apparently has historical accuracy since 75, have shown that Bernie Sanders will win.
So I mean, that sounds amazing.
We could keep our fingers crossed.
Let's just do that.
So next week, we'll probably be talking about the caucus and much more in the news. And that's all we have time for tonight. Our panel will see you at 6 next Friday. In the meantime, have a good weekend and thank you for listening. We're Bishops in a Bottle on OBU Radio. I'm Shumaita Rahman here with Urvija Rishi, Scott Payne, and Kyrie Burton. And we'll be signing off now. Thank you.
7:06 p.m.